survived. One of the things that happened as I was sailing through the air is that I assumed I was going to die, and assumed, therefore, that I would see God, and I was looking forward to the prospect. You know, you're flying through the air, and instead of being in a situation where I was fearful, I was relaxed. So when I landed on my feet, I was relaxed, and my body did not just smash into little bits. The difference was that I had hope. I was looking forward to something, not afraid of something. And consequently, I lived. A doctor told me afterwards, he said, if you thought you were going to die, you would die. He couldn't imagine how I could have thought I was going to die and would end up landing on my feet and surviving after that kind of a fall. And I am sure it's the difference in the way I thought about God. If I had come there thinking I was going to die and I was going to be facing hell, I would have died. But I came there really looking forward to something wonderful that was going to happen, and I lived. And that's kind of the story that I have today in terms of architecture. It's that kind of a thing that happened in the 12th century in Europe. And it happened more in France than it did in some of the other countries. It started there, and then it went out, and then it closed up again. So this is a rather fantastic story. And would you mind turning off the lights? And Evelyn is helping to turn on the machine.
Well, this is pretty intense.
This is a sign that I'm always hopeful that I can find a little trigger. I'm going to need the light again, please.
I believe it's over there by the cross, isn't it?
It's not here.
See, it was way over on the piano this morning. You must have cleaned this room last night.
Okay. And I've been taking for granted that it's been here. And this is, you know what this reminds me of? Some of those tangles that they draw the serpents up into in the Middle Ages and make it impossible for anybody to think positively.
Now, around the millennium, that was the Middle Ages.
The millennium was the Middle Ages. The Middle Ages actually run from, they say, from the time that Rome falls in 476. And I remember discussing, one of the first things I discussed with my son-in-law was, when does the Renaissance start? Because the Renaissance starts when the Middle Ages end, and it's kind of an overlap. And the Middle Ages, of course, is a name that is given in the 18th century to that period between what they considered the modern times and the classical times. And yet at the same time, the people who were living in the Middle Ages thought it was the modern times. What time are we living in now?
Modern times.
Sure. Just wait another millennium and we don't know what they'll call us.
What time period was the Dark Ages?
The Dark Ages were actually kind of two different times. 500 and 600 is when the...
Say it didn't work. Okay, got it.
Thank you. 500 and 600 is when the Rome had fallen. The cities were in great decline. People were moving into the countries, and at the same time, you had barbarian tribes moving in from the eastern part, from Asia, coming into Europe, and there was great battling, a lot of tribes going on, a lot of changes, not much written. We do not have a lot of information of what was going on in that time, and so that's part of the reason it's called the Dark Ages. Then there was another time, and that was at the end of the 9th century, the last half of the 800s, and into the 10th century, where you had another series of attacks. You had the Huns coming in and the Magyars, and they are attacking Paris until they get settled over in Hungary, and Saint-Étienne is crowned king by the Pope, and he Christianizes them like that. And at the same time, the Vikings that have been attacking northern France then are settled into Normandy, and they settle down and become farmers instead of rampaging thieves. So you have then, those are the two times that are really the negative, the black times in France. And yet it was not that way everywhere. And that's, in Italy, it didn't have some of the same experiences. Well, one of the things that, now thank you, one of the things that people were having when they had these dark experiences, these negative things happening, and I mentioned this last night, is that then the church became sort of a castle, a place where people could find a protection place. It was very important. It was a sanctuary in the ultimate sense. It was a place where people could go and find safety, because the world was not a safe place. You couldn't trust what was happening with nature. You couldn't trust God. And that was the ultimate thing. I could trust God when I went sailing through the air. But the people at that time could not trust God, because they saw God as a judge, not as a merciful God. And when you see God as a judge, you're going to see a whole different image of what God is. So their churches would be sanctuaries where they would have to go to find a certain amount of hope through the relics that they venerated, hoping that the saints whose spirit was still there with the relics would speak to God, plead with God to grant some mercy. So you had this sort of closed-in feeling. The churches were really quite dark. And there were the crypts underneath the altars, which were like caves, like the safe places that you could be. And one of the things this shows in art, and that's why I think looking at the art and looking at the buildings is very important for us to understand what's happening in the 12th century. These are the 1100s, and the 12th century is the century in which tremendous things happen. There was not another century like that for a long time. This is Conques. It's in a lovely, lovely valley, sort of between Albi and Arles, but much further north. And the pilgrims would come to this church, and you know the story that these people were not people who could read, and so therefore the art spoke to them, gave them the messages. So it's here in this church where we see one of the places where you have this tympanum, where God is standing there as in judgment. Here are those people who have made it into heaven. Supposedly this is that might be the church down here, and here is hell, a very great confusion. God, as the God of the apocalypse, is in judgment. God is a judge. And the devil is the wily one, willing to grab you, take part of you. And this is a time when there were many people in a lot of places that saw the earth as negative, as created by the devil, and the spiritual thing created by God, spiritual things only connected to God. So you couldn't trust the world. You couldn't trust the garden. You couldn't trust the weather. You could not trust anything. This is Altoona, and this is the day of confirmation when we were there. And this is where you see the actual measurement of people. What you did on earth made a big difference, whether you had a chance for going into heaven or whether you would end up as hopeless and even terrified by what was facing you in the future. This is Moissac. And here you have the God of the Apocalypse. And I want to read that passage from Revelation that talks about how awful, you know, A-W-E-ful God is. "Behold, a throne was set in heaven, and one sat on the throne. And he that sat was to look upon like a jasper and a sardine stone. And there was a rainbow round about the throne, in sight like unto an emerald. And round about the throne were 24 seats, and upon the seats I saw 24 elders sitting, clothed in white raiment, and they laid on their heads crowns of gold. And in the midst of the throne and round about the throne were 4 beasts full of eyes before and behind. And the first beast was like a lion, and the second beast like a calf, and the third beast had a face as a man, and the fourth beast was like a flying eagle. And they were full of eyes within, and they rest not day and night, saying, Holy, holy, holy Lord God Almighty, which was and is to come." I mean, it's a beautiful picture, but it's also very frightening when you see God as so transcendent, so far away from you that there is no way of communicating with such a God, such a judge. This is Sangüesa in Spain, done a little bit later. And I want to take a look at this. Here you have hell, much smaller space, but something is different. Obviously, it's a different artist. But at the feet of God is
Mary,
holding the baby Jesus. Now, that hasn't been in any of these other tympanums that we've seen. Bezalel, where St. Bernard called the Second Crusade. And here we have a tympanum, and this is just a little bit later than the one in Moissac and the one in Altoona. In fact, it's the same artist, supposedly, that created Altoona. And just in a few years you have a difference. You no longer have a judgment. Instead, you have Jesus sending out his apostles, go into the world and preach the gospel. Here the figure is huge, but it's within earth. Part of heaven and part of earth. And he says, go out and preach to everyone indiscriminately. And the figures around here are very strange figures. The zodiac is on the outside. And the figure, like to this pig nose people. In other words, preach to these. This is a different message. And then on the right side, and here's the figure of Jesus. It's not only active. Look at this. This guy's not sitting still. He's not just sitting up there away from everybody else in great judgment, but there's movement, there's activity, there's vivacity in the robes. And the hands are there in blessing, not in judgment. Also, it's in a mandorla, which is the shape of a vulva, which some people say this is a way of showing that there was a feminine aspect of God. And on the right-hand side of that, in the tympanum of the other door, is something also that has not been seen in church art before. Here is the Annunciation. Here is Mary's visit to Elizabeth. here is the birth of Jesus. Here are the shepherds and the angels coming to it. And here are the magi. Something is changing.
Well, what year would this be?
This is 1130. Now, what's happened between the time of 1077 and 1130 that has made this much difference?
God is more humanized, no?
God is more humanized. Now, what's caused that kind of thing? What's happened in between that? What event went on at the end of the 11th century, the end of the 1000s? I was talking about it on Monday, if you were here. In 1095, Pope Urban II accepted the call from Alexis Comnene in Constantinople and said, yes, I will send knights over to help you to get to help you fight against the Turks. And so he initiated the Crusades. Now, why would such an awful thing like the Crusades have made a difference in France? What happened when the soldiers went over to the Holy Land? What do you think would have happened? Take a chance. What do you think? What would have happened if you went to the Holy Land? What would you see?
Jerusalem.
You'd see Jerusalem. What happened in Jerusalem?
The crucifixion.
The crucifixion. Okay, what else would you see?
Bethlehem, baby.
Baby Bethlehem. What is important about Jerusalem and Bethlehem? Jesus was there. And so what happens is the Crusaders go to the Holy Land, and they discover that Jesus was a veritable man. He lived, he preached, he died. Now that's what happens to human beings. So that made that there was an aspect of God that was not just transcendent, so far above that you couldn't see or be in touch with God. And so these are paintings of Giotto's in the Scrovegni Chapel in Padua. But I'm bringing them here because they're all, I have a whole series of them. Here you have the birth of Jesus. Here you have the Magi coming to visit the baby Jesus. Here you have the death and the removing of the cross. What is common in all? Who is common in all those pictures?
Jesus.
Who is with Jesus all the time in each one of those pictures?
Angels.
Angels?
Mary.
Huh? Mary. Say it louder.
Mary.
Mary. Mary is with Jesus in every one of those pictures. And you see the Mary that really cares for Jesus. I was in Caltagirone in Sicily on Good Friday and stayed there through Easter. And they had on Good Friday, from the cathedral there, they brought the sepulchre out, a huge, heavy wooden sepulchre glass with the figure of Jesus in it, coming out of the cathedral to go on the parade while the drums went boom, 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 boom. And you know, I cried. Here was this figure of Jesus in the sepulchre. I mean, I knew it was just a doll, you know. But I cried. And after that came Mary. Mary, Mater Dolorosa, the mother of sorrows. And all over Sicily, all over Caltagirone, it was she that received the flowers and the prayers. Because somehow the people could connect with Mary They could not connect with a God that was transcendent. And they could see in Mary that Mary had a son that had died. And therefore, Mary could understand that they had also lost. And it was an astounding thing. So rather than seeing God as transcendent, as just as a pentapriter, as the ruler of the earth, you now see Jesus as someone who had actually suffered and hung on a cross. Does that make a difference? Does that make a difference? It certainly seems to have been very instrumental in making a difference in the 12th century. And then also part of that is not only that Mary cared, but one of the things that happens in the church is that not only is Mary seen as the mother, but also as someone who is then in heaven with Jesus and able to speak to Jesus. Now this, she does not get crowned yet. She does not get, actually, the doctrine is not written, inscribed into the church as Queen of Heaven until much later, nor that of the ascension into heaven. But what people believe and what the church actually says is doctrine does not happen simultaneously. And so what the people were saying is Mary is someone who is on the right hand of Jesus. Jesus can deny her nothing. So if you want to talk, get something, if you want to talk to God, you can talk to Mary. Mary will listen and then intercede for you. And so then, this is again much later, Mary is seen as a protectress, as the interceder between man and God. And of course, this is not the only thing that's happening in the 12th century, because the weather is getting better. And so instead of seeing the world as a hopeless place to be, you're not starving any longer. Things are getting better in a lot of different directions. And you have to, I wonder sometimes which comes first, the chicken or the egg here. But I think it happens simultaneously, that the world as people saw it was improving. So in 1140, Abbess Suger, Suger, who was the abbot in the Church of Saint Denis, or Saint Denis, which is the patron saint of France, decides to change his ambulatory, the place where people walk around. This is a story that he says has happened in the past when all the pilgrims have come here to venerate Saint Denis. He said, I've got to find a light, please. As the numbers of the faithful increased, the crowds of Saint Denis grew larger and larger until the old church began to burst at the seams. On feast days, it was always full to overflowing, and the mass of struggling pilgrims spilled out of every door. Not only were some pilgrims unable to get in, but many of those who were already inside were forced out by those in front of them. As they fought their way towards the holy relics to kiss and worship them, they were so densely packed that none of them could as so much as stir a foot. A man could only stand like a marble statue, paralyzed and free only to cry out aloud. Meanwhile, the women in the crowd were in such intolerable pain, crushed between strong men as if in a wine press, that death seemed to dance before their eyes. The blood was drained from their faces and they screamed as if they were in the throes of childbirth. Some of them were trodden underfoot and had to be lifted above the heads of the crowds by kindly men and passed to the back of the church and thence to the fresh air. In the cloister outside, wounded pilgrims lay gasping out their last breath. As for the monks who were in charge of the reliquaries, they were often obliged to escape with the relics through the windows. Now, that's a relatively acceptable history, apparently. He's not the only one that tells about the crush of pilgrims to get at the relics. So one of the things that he's going to do, by the way, Saint-Denis is a church where the kings of France are buried. It's still within Paris, but it's in a very industrialized part of town now. What he is going to expand the ambulatory, and he does it in a way that has never been done before. What you have here, these black spots here are pillars. This is a bit of wall. And what you have here are windows. So for the first time, instead of having a rather dark enclosure with chapels around that had very small windows, instead you had light. Light coming into this whole ambulatory, the place where people walked around the altar. It was a whole different situation. And he's using the rib vaulting, remember those arches that come together, so which support this whole area in a whole different way. He is breaking through in architecture, changing architecture. This is 1140. He has great ideas for his church because he sees now God as light and light streaming through the windows, part of our life with us, very imminent with us. God is not somebody just far away, and so he wants to bring all sorts of light into his church. Ultimately, this is the choir of Saint-Denis. He did not live to finish his job, and so this was done later. But this is, what a difference. The whole idea of bringing light in the church and raising the roof.
Excuse me.
Yeah.
There was stained glass there. I didn't know there was any glass whatsoever at that time.
Mm-hmm, 12th century.
There was glass.
Oh yes, stained glass. Oh, Beth.
But the other windows were just open, I imagine.
Well, actually, the first windows that he put in were really quite dark, and then lighter windows. The stained glass was really quite dark, and then he put in lighter windows. They put in lighter windows afterwards. But the jewel, the whole idea of jewels were very important in the Middle Ages. So the stained glass was also like putting jewels in your walls. He was said, but he wanted to build this church and make it an absolute palace for God. So he wanted to have the most beautiful riches, gold, jewels, things to ornament the church. And essentially, he succeeded. People from all over gave him jewels and riches and gold to be used in the church. And most of these then were taken out during the French Revolution. Actually, somebody asked yesterday, where did they get all the money? Well, realize that people at this time were saying, I will give you this land, I will give you this money, if you will say masses for me after I die. Because they're still hoping to get out of purgatory. They have this space between heaven and hell to deal with. This is a painting that comes later that gives us an idea of what Saint-Denis actually looked like. Tremendous gold, jewelry, and things like that. That Abbot Suger had managed to get into the Church of Saint-Denis. Now, not everybody thought that he was going in the right direction. And the most adamant person who argued with him was Saint Bernard, who was an absolute worshiper of the Virgin. This is a statue of the Virgin in the Church of Fontenay in France. Saint Bernard was a monk, a Cistercian monk that said, who pushed the monastery back to be very austere, to make life for the monks much more difficult than it had been with the Cluniac monks. I showed you the Church of Cluny last night. His church here has essentially no decoration. This is the church in Fontenay, and this is the interior. Now, it was denuded and used as I can't remember what it was, so it's no longer a church, but the architecture is the same. Nothing designed on the capitals, not very simple, very plain, very austere, at the same time a wonderful worship place. Well, St. Bernard says, that's wasting money. There are a lot of better ways of using your money than to just decorate the church. God doesn't need that. But on the other hand, Abbé Suger says, hey, you're going to do it for all the kings on earth. They're living with gold and jewels and wonderful cloths. Why don't you do it for the King of Heaven? That should be the most wonderful, beautiful palace there is. So you have that competition going between those two very distinct modes. There are great arguments in the 12th century dealing with those two men. And we can come and still debate that now, can't we? When we're talking about spending money for our churches and for our buildings, is this the way to spend our money, or should we give it to people who need it? We certainly ask that question with the government. Well, the first complete church that actually was built was Sens, S-E-N-S, in relatively northern France. It was begun in 1140, about the same time that Abbé Suger begins doing the one in Saint-Denis. One of the things that happens, if you're looking at any of these medieval churches, is it doesn't happen overnight. If you have a building program and you get an architect to make your building and expect to have it done in 6 months, it's not going to happen. We've got an architect here, you can verify that. What they would begin with would be the choir, the apse here. Start building here where people could worship temporarily and then gradually work backward in expanding the church as far as they needed it. So often when you'll go to these churches, you'll see that the design changes as you move further toward the west front. And then ultimately, the apse, which was done first, people will say, oh, it's out of date. We have to take it down and do it over again. So both things happened. So you often have that kind of change.
Which direction is the altar?
I'm not sure how it is in Sens, because most cases, the altar is toward the east, if they start from scratch, and the west front is where you enter. But yeah, there are times that, welcome Jeff, but there are times that if the church was put on a place of a pagan church, they would not change the alignment. So without going there and checking whether it is.
But the ideal was the altar be at the east.
At the east end with the light coming in.
I understand today our churches all faced east, whether they faced east or not. It's just by definition. The altar is at the east.
Mm-hmm.
Whether it's at the east.
Whether it's east. Okay.
They're at the east.
Well, look at the architecture up here just a little bit. Once you had the Gothic church, you had this type of architecture over and over again. You had the pillars and the capitals. You had the triforium. Right here, this is a blind arcade. In other words, right now, there are no open windows, so they call it blind. A blind arcade in the triforium. Sometimes this opens up and there's actually a gallery for people to walk in, even though people don't always walk in it. Then you have the clerestory on the third level. Sometimes there are four levels, so that's always an added challenge. One of the real discoveries, one of the real creative things about Gothic architecture is tracery. that you could build, have this tracery. Therefore, you could have the great rose windows. You could not have the rose windows without the tracery that held that glass in place. So here again, you have the pillars and the capitals, which are set up. This is the aisle space between the pillars and the wall. You have the triforium. You have the clear story. You have the rib vaults, which are supporting the ceiling, the transverse rib. You have then the buttresses that support these walls because there is no support within these. The old Romanesque churches had huge pillars, thick walls. That's why you do not have a large amount of light coming in. But by making the walls thin, you could put glass windows in there. But a thin wall won't stand up by itself. So you have to have the buttresses and then the flying buttresses that will support those walls. Together, you make these walls that are possible to have that kind of light. And I may not always be saying what I need to say here. If you have something to add or ask, I appreciate that. Not too long after Suger has done Saint-Denis or Sens, you have the west front of Chartres sculpted. And you actually, I don't have a very good pic, you know, I left so many slides at home, it's amazing I've got some. Here you have the apocalypse in the center again. But on over here is a tympanum with Mary, and on this side is a tympanum which shows the ascension. And in the ascension you also have a dove. So you have essentially the Trinity in these three portals here of Chartres, showing the Father, the Son, and the Spirit.
All those are statues chiseled out of stone.
These are all out of stone. And to some extent, the figures in Saint-Denis were much like this, but they've been very, very badly damaged. That Chartres is in such good shape is one of the amazing things, because most of the churches were very badly damaged, and many were destroyed. But these statues sort of stand apart. They're not just bas-reliefs. They are actually seem to stand apart from the building, and they're people. We haven't seen real people in this way. These are supposedly the kings and queens of the Old Testament. And there's a reality here that we haven't seen. Now, this is about 1150. Ultimately, you know very well that Chartres burned. The only thing that was left was this part of the west front. And they said there was the great miracle was that they had saved the veil of the Virgin from the fire. So immediately, Chartres was dedicated to the Virgin. And this is the Virgin of Chartres, which is a statue that was built much later. But essentially, the whole building now becomes a building, almost an adoration of the Virgin, which is very different than a building which is saying, I'm afraid of God. I'm afraid of what's going on in this world. And a lot of other churches were also dedicated to the Virgin. Notre Dame du Puy, with the Black Virgin there. A Black Virgin, a very mother, going back to very earthy things. This is Notre Dame in Poitiers, a very different kind of architecture. Here's Notre Dame de Canault along the Seine, with the Virgin sitting as queen with the child Jesus on her lap. is Notre Dame de Lyon. This is an interesting church. It's fairly far north. It was built, begun in 1180. Quite a different style of architecture, isn't it? There were going to be seven pillars like this, seven steeples like this on it.
It started 1180. Do you know when it was finished?
1225. So that's relatively quickly.
45 years ago.
Yeah. You know, one of the things they said that it would take 6 months for the mortar to dry. So they don't build churches fast.
Because they had no TV to spend their time.
No. No, actually, the Masons would go from one church to another. They'd build all they could at one church, then travel to another and build all they could, and then they could go to another. So they were actually traveling Masons. And I think that the stone cutters could stay in one place because there was a lot of work for them. One of the interesting things about Lyon is these bulls that are up here. Supposedly, they needed to have stones from the stone quarry and had no animals to pull them. And some oxen appeared miraculously and then and brought the stones in, then disappeared. And so they have put the bulls up on the steeple there. And probably the first time that labor, that people, the common people, were honored in some ways, which is a very different concept. Lyon, as you can see, has the pillars and the aisle, has a gallery and the triforium. Here's your blind arcade, and then the clear story up. So this Lyon has four levels going up to the rib vault. And I don't know how tall this was. It has an unusual flat wall here at the end of the choir with a rose window.
When did they start having chairs and places for people to sit?
Now that is a question I can't answer. I had no idea. No idea at all.
I suspect fairly recently.
Yeah.
Martin Luther's time was still.
They were still standing at Martin Luther's time. Yeah. And here's Chartres. Taking a longer look at Chartres, and of course you can see those flying buttresses here. And in the choir, which is much higher than some other parts, you definitely need them to hold up the walls. This is one of the things that happens, is that people say we're going to, later, 3 centuries later, they're going to say, build the second steeple, but we're going to do it a lot better than we did the first time. So they made this very fancy steeple. I'll say a little bit more about that. The west front here, part of this was from 1150, and then other things were added. So the church is built after the fire, which happens in the 1190s, then the rest of the church is built, and essentially it's done in about 30 years, which is astonishing and probably makes it possible for the church to have such unity. This is the choir. I wish I had better pictures for it. I've got to go back to Chartres someday when the sun shines. I was there and it was so dreary and so dark and so cold. There was no possibility of getting any decent pictures of the light that was there. But the stained glass windows in Chartres are its real treasure. Just beautiful. And you can see the tracery that holds these stained glass pieces together. This is the window of the Virgin with the child on her lap. The birth. See, these things are now very important in the churches and had not been there. The fact that Jesus was actually a man that rode on a donkey had been in the Bible, but it didn't seem to come through. And this is a part of the tree of Jesse. If you could have a person who is human, then he also had ancestors. And so then the tree of Jesse became an important figure in the and the stained glass. Here's that same figure of Mary F. Chart. On festival days, she's dressed very elegant. And you know what this is, the labyrinth. The labyrinth of Chart is very famous. If you want to come to our church, St. Christ Episcopal in Tacoma, you can walk the labyrinth. Because we're still in the process of ordering it and haven't laid it down permanently, but we are going to have one. And it is a marvelous station. I'll show you Bourges in just a minute, where you can see the labyrinth on the floor. This is right in the center of the church in Chartres. Now, because there are chairs, it's difficult. You've got to move the chairs out in order to walk the labyrinth. This is Notre Dame in Paris. Notre Dame in Paris was a little bit shorter than Chartres. Chartres was 118 feet. Notre Dame is only 107 feet, just a shorty. And in the center here of Notre Dame, the central portal, is a statue of Mary. Here she is, Queen of Heaven, wearing a crown, carrying the baby. Now, what has happened now, instead of seeing Jesus in the old pictures, you've often seen these medieval pictures of Jesus looking like an adult, a miniature adult. Okay, now you're beginning to see Jesus as a real child, a human child, so that you have this mixture, the divine and the human in one. This is the portal, the central portal, and you have the Dormition of Mary. Supposedly Mary, they say, did not die, but she slept. Then Jesus took her soul, we don't have that here, and brought it to heaven, and then here she is crowned in heaven. This is the central portal of Notre Dame in Paris.
When was that built?
I've got to look at my notes, excuse me. 1163 to 1250. Took a little longer, but if you see it here, okay, you can see it a little bit better here. And this is one of the Notre Dame's rose windows. This is one in the transept there. This is just marvelously huge windows. Here is another. This is the cathedral in Bourges. Marvelous flying buttresses. It's the best illustration for flying buttresses. And Bourges goes up 122 feet, not much taller than Chartres. There's something about Bourges that is extraordinary because the pillars that separate the main part of the nave from the aisle are so huge. So you have this extraordinary feeling of height, even though the main part of the church is not very high. The people are continually experimenting about how to create a building that has more potential in terms of bringing light. Whoops, that was supposed to go backwards. See if it will. Yeah. So you have, consequently, you can have large aisle windows because this aisle is so huge. So you have a lot of light coming in here. I must admit, when I was in Bourges, we had been bicycling, and it was springtime, and they'd been cutting grasses, and I'm not very allergic to things. But I got to there, and I was just sneezing all over the place. So my husband went to a pharmacy. He was speaking French, and went to a pharmacy and asked for something for me. And mom took me out. So instead of really enjoying Bourges, I was sleeping on one of the porches, one of the benches out here. They ultimately got me to a hotel, and I slept the night and then bicycled on to Vézelay the next day. But I've got to go back to Bourges and see the wonderful entrance doors here that they have. But Bourges is very tall. This is gives you an impression of looking up, and you have this feeling that God, that God can, you're in a place where God exists. It's a wonderful place. And the presence of being in this place is a presence that God is with you, and that light streaming through the windows helps. I had looked at pictures of Amiens and know how tall Amiens was. Again, all of this is in northern France, in the Champagne country, much of it, where they grow wheat and it was rich. They had gotten very rich. So there was money for building these churches. Amiens becomes 138 feet tall. An extraordinary place. And here's your labyrinth.
That's like a maze, right?
Well, it is like a maze, but you walk in and you walk out, and there's no wrong path to take. And so in the process of walking through it, you have a chance to think. Yes, Tom? Am I right?
Laura.
Is that your name?
I don't know about the name. But I'm, and another thing I don't know about is, liturgically, they don't have seats, they don't have rows, but how does the service work in this? Are people kind of milling around?
I suspect so.
And visiting the different windows? It almost sounds like a three-ring circus, or a 30-ring circus. Do you know anything about that?
Well, all I can say is that when I was in Agrigento in Sicily, on Palm Sunday, it was a three-ring circus, and they had pews. And what made it a three-ring circus is that the kids didn't sit down. They kept going around in circles, and they were just running and having a ball at the same time the liturgy goes on. And there was this sort of the liturgist would sing something, and the congregation would sing it back. And it was.
But that's today when they had.
That's today.
They had PA,
and they had pews.
And they had loudspeakers and all that.
Yeah.
Back then, I often wonder what.
You know, and I think a lot of times they would be going around the ambulatory. Actually, these churches were built so they could take in the whole village at once. They could actually have fairs inside here. There were a lot of things going on. Dogs would be allowed in. You seldom had to fill that church. And the church wasn't filled for a worship service, because it was made much too large for the people. You could take essentially the whole county and put, there was room for it in one church. So that's why they made it so large. You know, that's a very good question, because it brings up a lot of other things. That was, the church was made for the community, not just as a worship place.
Is it true that most of the churches you're showing us are pilgrimage churches?
They were also pilgrimage churches.
So
because they never stopped. One of the ways that they made money is by having pilgrims come to view their relics. So the better their relics were, the richer they became. And Chartres became very rich because they had the veil of the Virgin. And shortly after about 1130, it was amazing. There were all sorts of other relics of the Virgin and of Jesus that showed up that hadn't been around before. So there was the hair of the Virgin, the milk of the Virgin, there was a foreskin, I don't think that was there before. But there were, the fingernails of Jesus, things like that showed up that had never been around before. So suddenly you have that kind of, so you have more relics. And in the northern part here, because they didn't have the relics, you know, Rome had relics, Jerusalem had relics, so they had to create their own saints up here and have their own relics. So.
I know that in Speyer, you know, which was a huge church, that whole parts of whole villages would come in and live in there mm-hmm. and wait for the bishop or whoever yeah. it was to come. And maybe they'd wait a year. And they would, you know,
they would actually
give birth and die and, yeah. And just wait. Mm-hmm. And later on, they were used to, you know, in the plagues, they just laid out the dead in the church.
Oh, I didn't know about that because mm-hmm. I didn't know that they brought them. People were so afraid of the
churches,
plague
they did
that they were not always brought into them. Ultimately, the highest church that ever was built was Beauvais. And this was built up to 157 feet. This is the choir of Beauvais. And I must admit, it is a neck bender to see up there. They built it to the ultimate. Thin walls, huge panes of glass, to the ultimate that you could engineer the walls to hold up without any other structure but stone. But they went a little bit far. It's Beauvais. It's also in the Champagne area around the Île-de-France. This is where almost all of these early Gothic cathedrals were built. It didn't take long before you had parts of Beauvais falling. They rebuilt, and right now if you go to Beauvais, you only have about two piers. And then the rest of the church has completely fallen and they have not rebuilt it. But it's a beautiful, beautiful piece of architecture, a beautiful attempt at engineering, taking stone to the utmost.
No, this is obviously, did you take this picture or is this a commercial?
No, I didn't take this picture. Oh. But you have to have, for these interior pictures, I have interior pictures.
That, obviously, that portion is the portion that's standing.
That's the portion that's standing. And you have just a little bit beyond the choir. So within, all of this happens within about a century. So about 1150, you have the west front of Chartres being built. You have these figures here, and within about 75 years, they become much more human. When you have in the north and the south transepts, they are much more human figures. Look at the empathy here between Abraham and his son, Isaac. One of the ultimate other things that happened during this time is that Toledo in Spain is captured. You pick up some of the books and the learning that the Muslims have been saving, and you pick up a Greek philosopher that has been hidden. It's Aristotle. And Aristotle, believe it or not, they're going back, and what the St. Thomas Aquinas is trying to do is, in the 14th century, then in the 13th century, is to accommodate Aristotle with the Bible. He doesn't succeed too well and is ultimately labeled a heretic, but that's beyond the point right now. But he says, hey, you can trust your senses. He doesn't say it in those words, he uses Greek. But look at the world. It's real. Plato had said it was only a symbol of what actually was behind it. You couldn't trust what you saw. Aristotle says you can trust your senses. And so then you have another thing that's happening in the churches. And instead of having just capitals that don't show anything but a decorated imitative of nature, you actually have a nature here. What kind of leaf is this?
Oak.
No doubt. It's oak. And if you look carefully, you can see something under the oak. Can you see figures of... Mm-hmm. What do you see?
Squirrels or something.
It's like a lamb.
You know they would send the pigs out to get the acorns from under the oak tree. So what you have here is veritable pigs picking up acorns.
Yes.
And now you're beginning, so not only is man accepted, man sees God as imminent with us, not just transcendent, also sees that nature is no longer something to be frightened of, something of the devil, but nature is something that God has created as a blessing for us. So therefore we can put nature into the cathedrals. This is in Southwell in England. Can you see the difference in people's way people are thinking? You know, the trouble is they don't stay there. It doesn't take long before people are in competition. It becomes a materialistic world and say, how can I make it better than the next guy? Sainte-Chapelle is a beautiful thing, but it was built by St. Louis for the King of Thorns, but it's already gone beyond. It is no longer a place where you can sort of worship God and sit and feel the presence of God. Now it's a place where it's a jewel box. Mm-hmm. And you know, I don't have a picture of Milan Cathedral, but you know what it looks like?
Yeah.
It's just huge, dripping with sculpture. And then this is the direction that the Gothic, after 1250, the Gothic goes. And so for 100 years, from about 1150 to 1250, you have this wonderful creative energy that creates the Gothic Church, the ultimate Gothic Church. And after these, it was never as good. So that's the miracle. That's the miracle. And it's almost time for lunch. And I don't want to be late for lunch.
One question.
Yeah, question, yes.
Where does the Renaissance fit into all this?
See, this is about 1250. 1300 is the time that Dante Alighieri does the Divine Comedy. It's the time that Giotto paints some of those pictures that I showed you here. We're going into humanism when we're starting to show people as real people. So the Renaissance becomes much more humanistic. They say Leonardo da Vinci is drawing is saying that, you know, man is the measure of mankind. God is the measure of mankind. So we're going in that direction. Where does it end? Where does it start?
It's interesting you say the Crusades really are the source of a lot of the changes made, and even the inspiration for a lot of the cathedrals then.
Well, it changed people's way of thinking about Jesus. See, that's the difference. At least that's what I read. You know, I wasn't there, so I can't swear. But that seems to be the intellectual reasoning. And so, you know, one of the questions you have always comes in between reason and faith. There was a lot of faith, but what did you believe in? And when you began to see that God could be real, could be human, your faith changes.
So. How many of these churches were bombed out in World War II?
We did a pretty good job of protecting churches. The German, in France, they were pretty well, they took all the glass down and they were replaced after the war. But these churches were not bombed, which says something about the Germans not bombing them too. There was the what is a church in England that was bombed so badly?
Coventry.
And so that was decimated, and they have rebuilt that cathedral. And there was a lot of damage to German churches.
Well, they tried to bomb St. Paul's too, but they kept protected the people protected.
Uh-huh. So actually there was more damage during the French Revolution. Mm-hmm. Because they wanted to explode these. The people were so angry with the priests and the monks that had been taxing and taking money from them to build these churches. I mean, see what Abbot Suger had been doing is just exactly what was driving the people nuts. And they said, you know, let's get rid of these. And so they bombed the churches and they turned them into quarries. And Chartres was saved. The other churches actually that I've shown you were actually turned into stables, turned into this or that, and were only saved by flukes. So we only have some of the churches that were built. Yeah. We'll keep on asking questions, but you don't always have to stay for to hear me answer them. So if you want to stick around, but you are free to go as you choose.